Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Phoenix Business Radio, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studio inside Max 6 Workspace and the Conscious Capitalism Arizona headquarters in Tempe, Arizona, where we help build businesses and connect you with the right people. I'm Karen Nowicki, and today's special segment is really all about connecting you with the right people and really finding a way to make massive change in not only our city of Tempe or Arizona or the USA, but all over the globe. So with that very proud and excited introduction, I'm going to welcome back to the studio Eileen Boris, psychologist with Thunderbird School of Global Management. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I think it's been just a little over a year. Did we think?
Exactly a year.
Yes. And a bigger studio. We already celebrated that. We can actually move around. We've got some natural light coming in. You've been busy since we've seen you last.
I have. Matter of fact, I just came back from Afghanistan, which was quite an experience, working to empower women and to give them political voice. And so what I basically did was to develop a persuasion curriculum with a few other people from the Thunderbird for Good program at Thunderbird. And so I worked on it. We even developed a card game that went with it, and then went to Afghanistan to train these women, these awesome, courageous, resilient women, in how to develop a persuasive argument, how to write a really good letter, and all the things that go with it. And for us, we might not think much of this, but there, every time they move out of their homes, they become targets. So we all had targets on our backs if we were ever caught doing something to just improve their lives. And the stories that they told me were just so heart-wrenching of what they have to go through just to be able to help other people, which we just take for granted. So it was a powerful experience. Living in a war zone is very intense. I have to admit, I was very glad to get back to the U.S., but it was so worth it because of these incredible women, and they knew the sacrifice, and they were so thankful, and they were from all over the country. They were from every single province in Afghanistan. Some had to fly, some drove, they had to get permission, some had to come with escorts. It's just so incredible to see what they had to do. And we couldn't even give them the materials, because if they were caught by the Taliban, they probably would be killed. So they can get it on computer, but that's how careful we had to be. It was amazing. It's amazing what women go through around the world. We are so lucky here in the U.S.
So much to talk about.
Exactly.
That trip and everything that you're up to. But what a great way to start off our segment by simply sharing that experience, that very recent experience. So we'll definitely come back to that. Eileen, when you knew that we're going to have this segment again, we always like to say to our guests, think of somebody that you'd love to have come on and speak with you so that it's a well-rounded conversation beyond just what you and I would be able to do. And so you were gracious enough to invite to join us today the founder and director of the annual Genocide Conference at Scottsdale Community College, Mr. John Lifeton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
We're thrilled to have you. And if you wouldn't mind just speaking out, this is kind of off the cuff, but as you hear Eileen share just that brief little example of, you know, what she's been up to, what comes to your heart and mind? Because I know you're a world traveler. You've been traveling all your life. And then, of course, you have a passion and a mission for similar work. Can you just speak candidly about what you're hearing? And then we'd like to learn a little bit about you.
Well, as the founder director of the Genocide Conference, which we started, I started 8 years ago, my responsibility is to make sure that it's fresh every year, something new and different, different speakers, different perspectives, obviously different genocides all over the world. So I try to do that. So for example, like last year, we focused on one day, which was dealing with the Holocaust. We focused on the return of Nazi loot to the families. This year, it's quite different. On that particular Holocaust-dedicated day, we're going to focus on the Jewish diaspora to Asia. So we're talking about the Jews who went to Shanghai and the Jews that went to Manila in the Philippines. So that's one of the ways that I change it. But then we're bringing in people who are from Rwandan survivors or people who are survivors from Kosovo. We always include the Armenians because of the what the Turks did to the Armenians in 1915. But that's expanded now, and we do Assyrians as well. But those are past genocides. And the key thing to recognize is that there are still issues from these genocides that affect contemporary life. So, for example, if you look at the Ukraine in the 20s, there was the Holodomor, which is the Ukrainian word for their genocide, in which 20 million people were killed underneath Stalin because of collective farming and him taking the food back to Russia, but not feeding the Ukrainians. There was a diaspora of Ukrainians. Many went to Canada, the prairie states where they could grow wheat like they did in the Ukraine and such. But that bad feeling, it's still with us today. And as and when Putin invading Ukraine or taking the Crimea, there's still a lot of bad blood there. And he's, you know, there's no love lost between Ukrainians and Russians. And so with him funding the people on the eastern side and to having this kind of quasi-civil war, it all stems and goes right back to the Holodomor. And all those things are really important. And today, and this is really interesting about what Eileen was just talking about with regards to women. Today, Omar al-Bashir in Sudan was overthrown. There was a coup last night and the army took over. Well, he's wanted for crimes against humanity and genocide. It'll be interesting to see what takes place out of that. But what Eileen was saying really brought home about women, because they're the ones who started this recent rebellion because of the increase in prices in bread and in fuel. 70% of the women were out on the streets and were demonstrating against the government. And the military apparently sided with them and overthrew Bashir, Omar al-Bashir, and he's in jail now. So it was an interesting development just today.
Timely. And I don't know until this is ever no longer a conversation, which, of course, we all hope in our lifetime that we'll see that. There's never a time that this conversation is not timely.
You know, it's amazing. When I was listening to you speak too, John, it reminded me of other movements that women spearheaded, like in Liberia, where the women just weren't going to deal with Charles Taylor anymore. And so they began to form and have sit-down strikes. And it first started with the Christian women, and they invited the Muslim women. And so this movement got bigger and bigger and bigger, where the women couldn't be ignored anymore. And then when the peace talks started to happen in Nigeria, the men who were invited, they got their ways paid for. The women had to find their own means. But they got there. They got there. And they sat in that hall where the peace conference took place. And they made a statement. They would not let those people leave the conference rooms. They said, listen, you're not here to have fame and fortune and good meals and fun. You're here to do work. And if it means taking off our clothes, because that's a big no-no, we will do it to make you stay.
Mm-hmm.
It's the force of the women who end a lot of these conflicts nonviolently and say things have to change. And it's the women and the children who suffer the most.
That's true.
Yes.
That's absolutely true.
So, John, tell us about the conference a little bit more. It's coming up this next week, correct?
Yes. Opening day is Monday, the 15th of April. The conference is every April, because that's Genocide Awareness Month because of Rwanda, with the 100 days of the genocide in Rwanda 25 years ago this year. And it's it starts at 9 in the morning. It's totally free and open to the public. Starts at 9 in the morning, and we have 6-7 speakers a day, and it goes till about 8 o'clock at night. 6 days of presentations and a couple of workshops involved. I partner with several very good nonprofit organizations and museums, such as the Holocaust Museum in D.C., the Shoah Foundation, the Memorial de la Shoah in Paris, to name three. And this year we have a major exhibit from the Memorial de la Shoah. It's called From Hollywood to Nuremberg. It specifically talks about Fuller and Ford and Sullivan, who were directors who actually saw the camps and filmed the camps. And some of their footage was used in the Nuremberg trials. But it went on to affect their careers. So when they made The Diary of Anne Frank or other films that came after that, they used their experiences during the war on that. We have that as our exhibit. It's grown into being the largest genocide conference in the world. We have around 3,000 attendees just for the presentations and the lectures. For the educational exhibits, we'll have 8,000 to 10,000 people come in. The farthest afield we ever had someone fly in from, was all the way from Papua New Guinea.
Wow.
Which was amazing, you know. I mean, we've had them from Australia and Europe and elsewhere, but Papua New Guinea was just, that was an unusual one. And this guy flew in specifically to see to visit the conference and be there for 3 days, which was
amazing.
Pretty nice, you know. So.
This takes probably a lot of people and months, if not at least a year of planning.
I'm already working on 2020 and
2021. I was going to ask, no doubt.
Yeah, it takes a long time because sometimes to get people, you have to book them a couple of years in advance and such.
Eileen, have you attended previously?
I have, and it's an incredible event. It's really heartwarming, and I'm actually going to be speaking at this event as well. When I went last year, and I don't know, John, you might kill me for this, but his story of how he became interested in this is what really inspired me. And so last year when I went, of course, I'm interested in the work of Rwanda because I've done work there. And it was I went to hear somebody who actually lived in Rwanda and did amazing things in Rwanda. And after that week, John said, well, you know, next year's coming. He's not kidding when he starts booking out. And so my whole life was, I'm saving that 1 week. I can fly to Afghanistan as long as I'm back by that time. It's a very moving experience. It's, I think, an extremely important experience for people to have. You know, people might think this is really heavy and you know, difficult to hear. And some of it is, but some of it we need to be reminded because genocide is still happening. And we have to really think, is this the world we want to create? Do we want to continue with all of this anger and the hatred and kill people just because they're different from us? And the stories, the narratives that are perpetuated that aren't true? So this work is really, really important. And my hat's off to you, John. And
well,
I do hope you
much.
Tell that story.
Yeah. We would love to, if you would be willing. How did you get involved in genocide studies?
Well, I happened to be working in Macedonia for the American Association of Community Colleges. I mean, I was with Scottsdale Community College, but I was in Macedonia setting up a program there for them. And it had to do with English and the English program. And so I flew back through Prague because it was a spring break, so I had a little bit of time. So I flew back through Prague because I hadn't been there. And so get off the plane, snows up to my rear end, which I hadn't experienced for years. And I start going through the city and such. And I'm just seeing what is available to do. And I see a kiosk and it says Theresienstadt or Terezin, which was the ghetto in the concentration camp. So I thought, well, I've never been to one. I'll go. So I hopped on the van the following morning. We went out there. It's about 45 minutes north of Prague, northwest of Prague. And we get out there. There's only one other individual on the van. It's an Australian guy. And we get off, and there's a little museum there. And nobody's there. It's really cold. It's been snowing, and nobody's there. So we kind of walk around the ghetto area that was a propaganda ghetto. The Nazis used it to make a film that they showed to the IRC, the International Red Cross. And they bought it hook, line, and sinker that the Jews weren't being treated badly. That's a very interesting story, but it's a long one. But nonetheless, so I went through there and then there's about a 15 to 20 minute walk down this road where you go to where the prison was. So you can go through the prison. I don't know what happened to the Australian guy, but he kind of disappeared. And so I was there on my own. And it's really moving to be in a place like that, where you walk underneath the gate, which says Arbuk Makfai. You go in and you see these bunks that people slept in, the wooden bunks that you've seen pictures of Elie Wiesel and all that. And nobody's there except you. And it's very moving. So I went through the prison and there's this little door and you go out to a field where they executed people. And there's a wall with a little kind of like a dike up in front of it. And there's these poles where they would tie people up and shoot them. And there's a gallows on to the right of that. So I walked out and there's a road that leads out. You go out this little gate and there's a road there. And that's where the SS commandant lived. And that's where the guards lived and such. And I noticed there's a Olympic size swimming pool to the right on the left hand side. So it would be, so I was thinking to myself, here's this commandant who's on this balcony overlooking the swimming pool and he sees his children and his wife, you know, and other people. All these kids are playing in the pool and then some poor individual is being forced to walk down the road. And that's the last thing he sees before he's killed. I can tell you that the swimming pool was maybe 4 feet from the wall, 5 feet from the wall. Mm-hmm. So these kids are swimming and playing in the pool. And on the other side of the wall, people are being executed and they can hear that. And I really had a hard time wrapping my head around that. I still do. Because I don't know how anyone could subject their children to that. At the same time, you know, the whole inhumanity of the individuals being killed. And that really affected me. So a couple of years later, I was called by the Holocaust Museum and said, would you do a workshop in Phoenix? It was in June. Hot. Nobody's here. No teachers. I said, okay. And we did it. And we had 130 teachers show up in the middle of the summer. And it really went well. So I went to the president. I said, can we do another? Can we do it again, but better maybe in April when teachers are here? And she said, yeah, go with it. And so I started planning this out. And I thought, oh, it'd be like a little 2-day conference, you know, maybe a Thursday and a Friday and some Saturday, maybe some bits of Saturday. And so many people were keen on speaking and getting the word out and talking about their situations from different groups, Armenians, Assyrians, Jewish community, that it just grew into a 6-day event. And then it's just taken off from there. So it's very exciting. For me, it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, I feel like I'm actually doing something. And because people come up to me and it's actually affected them. I've had students come up and say, oh, you've ruined my life. I wanted to be an accountant. Now I want to go help people.
Yeah, and, darn you.
and I had this girl, I said, well, go ahead and be an accountant. Then go work for an NGO and help somebody out. I have one student he's with Doctors Without Borders now in Africa. And so it's I think it's doing some good.
Well, clearly.
Now you see why I wanted him to tell the story.
Yes, and this is radio, so I'm emotional. I had to grab tissue. I'm grateful for the work that you're doing. I can imagine how that felt for you. I can't imagine it ever leaves you. It's not ever going to leave me, and I didn't have the benefit or the misfortune to stand there and experience that.
Just hearing this story just makes my stomach turn because of the humanity against humanity, the inhumane treatment. You know, on the one side, you're seeing people having a good time and kids playing in the pool and all that, and others are being killed just because they're Jewish. I mean, that just gets right to my heart. And that's what's continuing today.
I was just going to say, yeah, to your point earlier, this continues to happen all over the globe.
I mean, we've said never again, never forget, never again since 45. And since 45, there have been over 100 million people killed, mm-hmm, because of genocide. Women, children, elderly, not combatants usually, but women and children and the elderly. 100 million people. And it's happening right as we sit here in China with the Uyghurs and Myanmar with the Buddhists killing the Rohingya Muslims. And right this very nanosecond, it's happening.
You know, it's interesting. I remember when I was a little girl, I grew up in a German-Jewish family. My father had to leave Germany because of the Holocaust. We never spoke about it. It was just, you know, erase it, deny it. But my aunt and uncle in Baltimore did speak about it. And I remember seeing something written about Adolf Hitler. And I asked my aunt and uncle about it. And we talked, and I remember them saying, never again. And I remember, I must have only been 9 years old, thinking, never again to anyone. And I'm sure that's what had given me the inspiration to do what I'm actually doing today, because my stomach turns every time I hear a story like what you shared or what's going on in the world, because it's got to stop. This hatred has to stop. And that's basically how I think I became involved in becoming a clinical and political psychologist, and now ultimately talking a lot about political forgiveness, which is healing on all levels of society. So this would never happen again.
I know this is a huge question, but how do we heal from hate?
The first thing is we've got to allow the stories to be told. We have to hear each other's stories with an open mind. We have to be willing to face our toxic past. And, you know, now I'm talking about U.S., but this is true for any country. We have to be shaken out of denial to see what's really going on and to understand that we are all part of the problem, that we have to wake up and recognize, what are we doing that's perpetuating, let's say, structural violence? What are we doing that perpetuates the hate? And really become self-reflective and allow ourselves to really hear the other and to allow ourselves to grow in empathy. I mean, we're all feeling the empathy here. That's something that everyone needs to be able to feel, is that empathy and that understanding, so we can begin to understand the other person's reality, the other person's psychological landscape, so we can understand those different narratives and the emotional underpinning of those narratives, so we can begin to not only look at that, but to develop new narratives that include everyone. It's a tall order. It's, you know, I said it in 2 minutes, but to make those changes doesn't happen in one day. And, you know, I think about what's going on in this country. We need so much structural reform. That's not going to happen overnight. And we here have to be shaken out of our denial and recognize how we're perpetuating all of this violence and to be able to listen to those stories. And it's very hard. It's very hard if you were wanting to tell me a story and I was from a hostile group. You're feeling pretty vulnerable. And so we have to learn to really be open and to allow those stories to be told without blame, without judgment, and to really understand the pain and suffering that has gone on so we can make different choices and do things differently.
Hard enough to do as an individual or a family. So what comes to mind, and I know you've worked with married couples in the past, certainly plenty of individuals, it's hard enough for us to come to that place of understanding, compassion, and forgiveness when it's just one-on-one or even within a small family, a neighborhood situation, or a workplace. You're talking about and leading one of the leaders in this charge around healing nations. I can't even wrap my brain around that. And yet in the same breath, I'm so grateful that this is who you've known that you've been called to be.
And it's interesting, you know, I grew up in a situation where there was so much hatred and killings. And now I'm married to this wonderful Tibetan who's going through cultural genocide all the time. And so it seems to be a real theme of what I'm dealing with. And so, yes, I'm very highly motivated and inspired to do this. And it's not easy. It does take individuals to be healed. It takes individuals to learn how to forgive and to be transformed from forgiveness. And that's why I still have my private practice and want to work with as many individuals as I can, because the individuals create the platform for the next step. And the next step is bringing communities together in ways that are non-threatening and developing processes that are healing. And, you know, and I think of, because we're talking Rwanda, I'm also thinking Sierra Leone, who has a process called Fumble Talk, where in their culture, storytelling is very important. And they get around a bonfire in a community to welcome let's say, child soldiers in, and they have a whole process of talking about forgiveness and reconciliation and how to come together and the storytellings, and then doing group things like farming together for the villages and all kinds of things. We can have processes of town halls where communities come together and share their stories and have sacred circles. And in fact, there was, believe it or not, there have been two Truth and Reconciliation Commissions here in the United States, one of which is Maine, where they've done sacred circle work. And we can talk about that later, which is really wonderful.
We can talk about that right now. Right now. So speak more to that.
Okay. I'm going to backtrack a little bit to Canada, because Canada was probably the inspiration for Maine and for Greensboro, North Carolina, which is where we've had two Truth and Reconciliation Commissions.
And TRC is your acronym for that.
Right, TRC. Okay. So I can now use TRC. Everyone knows it's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
The Canadian one was with Indigenous peoples.
Right. What was going on in Canada was that they were taking their native, the Inuit, and the natives there, the Aboriginals, and they were going to save the man by taking out all the Indian in them, so to speak. And so they had these Indian residential schools, and they got all the Native Americans there and brought them to these schools and were really committing cultural genocide. And so they had to learn the ways of the white men. They were put in foster homes of the white person. Their hair was cut. They couldn't speak their language or practice any of their spiritual practices. This went on and on and on. And finally, in the year 2000, I can't remember, 8, something like that, or 2002, they started this commission. It was similar to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where it was a top-down approach. The government initiated it. They were investigating the crimes of the Indian residential schools and the churches that supported this. And so they took the step to really see what was going on and to stop these practices and all of that. The problem was that the government didn't look at itself. And this was one of the problems of South Africa. You know, they defined what truth and reconciliation was. And so you begin to marginalize the groups that are contrary to the dominant theme. But it was a step. And then, well, actually, Greensboro started before Canada. Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1979, there was an incident where the Ku Klux Klan and Nazi parties came, and they went to a rally that peacemakers were having to protest economic and social injustice. And they opened fire and they killed a number of people. And years later, the community decided to come together to see what had happened. Because not only was no one really brought to justice, those Ku Klux Klan members and Nazi Party members that did go on trial, it was an all-white jury. So they were never convicted, and the police that did the shootings were never convicted. But they started something because it was a community-based Truth and Reconciliation Commission supported by civil societies. So they were able to step away from the mistakes that other Truth and Reconciliation Commissions had, but one of the problems that they faced, which was a lesson learned, they didn't have the government buy-in. So the government only said, well, we're sorry. They put out a statement of regret, and it never went further than that. Fast forward to Maine. It was the Maine Wabanaki Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what happened there was that there were so many Native Americans now who were being forced, just like what happened in Canada, to these residential schools and to foster homes to change the way of the Native Americans to become white again. And so what happened was that there was a group of concerned citizens that came together with the Wabanaki tribe, and they formed their community Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they did have a little support of the government, but not enough. And yet again, it could be a model. They started using sacred circles, and the stories that the Native Americans were able to share were heartbreaking. And of course, the anger they were feeling toward the white men, understandable. And yet, at least with the Maine Wabanaki Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they were able to bring together some of the white population with the natives so they could at least hear these stories. Now, Maine is pretty homogeneous. And what happened there, and which is something we have to think about in the United States, is that there were so many non-native people who were just totally disengaged with the process. But we were learning a lot. And I really do feel that we can have a truth and reconciliation. I should say many truth and reconciliation commissions. We're too diverse in this country, and we're not investigating one crime or one group. And so I think if we're going to develop something, which I think we should, it should be community-based, regionally-based. And so we may not have one national process, but we can have one national way of supporting. So the government could get funding to support these smaller initiatives, and then a different structure that can begin to investigate structural violence throughout the country and be able to enforce new regulations that stop the structural violence and that support structural change, forgiveness, and reconciliation. So I, for one, really want to be able to somehow initiate this and work on it more to help heal, as you were asking, the hatred, at least in America.
So who do we need to get you in front of? And John, chime in here. Like, how does that happen? What needs to take place? Who needs to be listening? Who do we need to be in front of?
Well, there may be a ray of hope here in that after Pittsburgh, I don't know if you were there, but I went down to the Jewish Historical Society where the ADL was there, and there were government officials and such, but there were Muslims. There was all sorts of people who had got together because they agreed that this was a horrible thing, the killing of the murder of the people at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And it happened again after Christchurch. So there's at least there's a will, there's a base of people that want to do it. But unfortunately, what happens is people meet, they say the prayers, you know, and nothing happens. And one of the gentlemen that is speaking, Oscar Knoblauch, who's a survivor, Holocaust survivor, I remember we were chatting, and he said he gets so angry at legislators because he said, they say, oh, well, there's another school shooting, we'll pray. And he says, forget the praying. He says, you know, and the same with Father Zachariah from the Armenian church. He says, forget the praying. That's my job. He says, go and do something. Change the laws. He says, do something. And that's where we get all these people, this base that they feel, they agree with Eileen.
And then there's no call to action.
But there,
exactly.
Where do we go from here?
Well, it's interesting because there's some novel things that are being done in Montgomery, Alabama. A man named Brian Stevenson, who's a civil liberties lawyer, got educated at Harvard, came back to Alabama where he's from. He's African-American. And he is very much in support of people telling their stories. And so he's initiating some very novel ways of how to do that. And one of the things he's doing is he's going around where lynchings took place in the South. And he's taking the dirt from those places, and he's creating memorials from the dirt. Hmm. He's also developing markers that mark the places where slave trade happened in Alabama.
These visual reminders.
Exactly. He had gone to Berlin, and he was so impressed with what he saw in terms of the Holocaust. You can't go a few feet without seeing some kind of memorial or some kind of reminder about the Holocaust. And I know when I teach in Frankfurt, there are things that I see also. It could even be something like the showing of Anne Frank, but you know there's that's there. you know that people have really come out of denial about it and they want the world to know. And that's what we need to do in the United States. And so that's what was the inspiration for Brian Stevenson. So he's been doing this, which has been creating conversations. And we need more of that. And that could be a beginning of people starting to take responsibility. And by the way, there were like over 4,000 lynchings that took place through 12 states in the South. That is just incredible to think that that's part of our history. And we need to talk about it. We need to become aware. So we do need these organizations. To get back to your original question, who do we need to get in front of? We need more organizations, civil society organizations, to step up to see what they can do to start shaking everyone out of denial. We need to start developing relationships with the Native American tribals, you know, the chiefs and people who run that, to see how we can begin to start addressing what needs to be addressed. And one of the major lessons is that we need to get the governments involved, the state governments. If governments aren't behind it, nothing happens except for goodwill. And goodwill is great, but we need more action. So we need the governments to get involved. We need people in government to be willing to step forward and say, okay, we're going to look at that, and be willing, knowing that they're going to need to be investigated, the government policies. And so we need to get together people on the individual level who are still suffering from things passed down from generation to generation, people on the community level who can work to make some of these changes, and the government. And we need the funding. And funding is a challenge. And right now, so many people in the United States, they probably are saying, I had nothing to do with racism. I had nothing to do with what happened to the Native Americans. That might be true, but we're all benefiting by the structures that have been set up for the elite and which marginalize the others. So I hope that kind of gives you an idea.
Yeah. And in Arizona, the Phoenix Holocaust Association, of which I'm on the board for, just recently worked, Cheryl Bronkus, the president, did an exceptionally good job working with Janice Friedbaum and some others from there to work on with Representative Udall to get something passed in the House. And it has passed in the House. It hasn't gone before the Senate yet. But it's that it should be taught in schools. Now, is this a kind of a hot, everybody can say that and say, oh, yes, wonderful, and they all jump on the bandwagon. But is there going to be any funding towards that? And that's a key thing, is the funding. But it needs to be talked about. There was a young lady in here, and she was sitting front row center, so I knew she was going to be a good student, first day of class. I gave my spiel, and at the end I said, does anybody have any questions? And she raised her hand, and she says, excuse me, what is genocide? And I said, what?
And she's 18, 19 years old,
right out of the Scottsdale Unified School District. And she didn't have a clue. And I said, well, have you heard of the Holocaust? And she goes, yes. And I said, okay, Holocaust is for Jewish people and for people from World War II. But genocide is for others. And she had no idea. Now, she was a great student. She took the ball.
Well, thank goodness she had the wherewithal to ask that question, because I'm sure she wasn't the only one in that room that didn't know and weren't willing to ask.
And that's why something like Genocide Awareness Week, like what you're doing, and the Genocide Awareness Month is so important, because those that suffered through the Holocaust, for the most part, have died already. People aren't hearing these stories anymore. And we've got to hear these stories. And we've got to take a look at how can we stop it never again. And if it's not taught in schools, if we don't have things like the Genocide Awareness Week where people can ask those questions, if we don't have other things that mark what this is all about, and not just the Holocaust in Germany, not just Rwanda, but what's happening in so many other countries and other places, and what we're doing, people will just turn a blind eye. Because they're not interested. Their lives are good. Why should they, you know, step into the mucky muck and do something for someone else?
If you look at Dr. Greg Stanton and his 10 steps of genocide, his last step is denial that it ever happened, because that's still perpetuating genocide. that's a situation now. We see Turkey denies what they did with the Armenians, Assyrians, and Greeks. And we see the United States has not even recognized the Armenian genocide officially at the federal level. 49 states have. But at the federal level, we haven't, because we're so worried about our air base in Turkey. We haven't admitted about the great silent genocide of the Native Americans. And our boarding school thing, if you look at the 1948 UN Resolution 268-3, the fifth point, point E, is forcibly transferring children. And we did that, too, with mm-hmm. boarding schools. Mm-hmm. And Colonel Pratt's famous or infamous statement of that, well, kill the Indian and save the boy.
Man.
You know, I mean, how horrible.
I'm not sure how to ask this question, but I feel like it's an important question to ask. Storytelling, keeping these stories in front of us are obviously critical, because through storytelling, I mean, for as long as we've been on this earth, storytelling is a method of communication, right? And it keeps us feeling. When we have families or even politicians or whomever it is telling the story, sometimes we stay locked in our belief based on the way the story's told, mm-hmm. and it doesn't benefit us, if that makes sense,
yeah.
right? So while storytelling is important, we want the threshold to be the reason I'm telling the story and the reason I'm having you feel what I felt, just like you talked about when you went and you stood there, is to find the way to forgiveness and healing. But if I'm a grandparent or I'm a parent and I'm giving that story, but with that hatred slant and that victim slant, then my child and my children will then go on continuing to have that in their understanding right. of what's taken place. And so
the intergenerational trauma gets passed down. Unfortunately, people do get stuck in the victim role, which is what you're talking about, the poor me. And that's where the work of forgiveness really comes in, because you tell me your story, I hear the pain, but now I have to help you deal with the anger and help you express it and mourn the loss. If, you know, and sometimes people get stuck in the mourning. That's why I'm mentioning it. But eventually get you to a place where you can hear the other story. And the other story then becomes painful for you to hear. And, you know, just like horrible things happened to Jews in the Holocaust, what was going on for the German people? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make it right, it doesn't make it good, but it is what it is. And that's why we have to be open to hearing it. I mean, some people were working in concentration camps because it was the only way they could make money to feed their family. That's pretty horrible. So there's always another side to the story, and the story is not over. And that's what we have to understand. So for us, let's say in the United States, we hear African Americans talk about the horrific things that have happened to them because of structural violence, which would be hard for me as a privileged white person hearing, or a Native American story. I can make different choices to help change structures. And so now their story and my story can become our story of what did we do that made a difference. And that gets passed down too.
That storytelling is really crucial. And it reminds me of Rwanda and the Gacacas that they had afterwards, which is their sort of
their TRC
village
grassroots
trial. And they really were essential in work, because you couldn't take tens of thousands of people who were perpetrators, because at the time the death penalty was there. If you murdered somebody, you were supposed to be killed. Well, you can't do that. You can't have mass judicial killings of Rwandan citizens. So they had this gachacha where the individual would come and he would apologize. He would say exactly what he did, be it rape somebody or kill somebody, whatever it was, which was horrible for the people listening to it. But at the same time, they could then. And they grieved again, but at the same time, they could hear the story, hear it from the perpetrator, and then move on from that. And a really interesting thing about that is the individual who was the perpetrator, once he told the story, he eventually was accepted back into society because he had nothing to hide and everybody knew what he had done. And so it was, okay, you've done that. and we know. And so there was this, there's a certain rapprochement between these people.
And part of that, too, was the fact that when the perpetrator told their story, they were coming clean. They were taking responsibility. They had an opportunity to show remorse.
Right.
And that spoke to the others. And the others had an opportunity to say how they were really feeling. So all these feelings had a safe space, in a sense, for it all to come out so they can begin to choose to do something differently. And the victims and the survivors, they wanted to know what happened to their loved ones. They wanted to know where they could find them again. They wanted to know why things happened the way they did so it could make some more sense to them. And again, it doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it good. But people need to know it.
We need to know.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we have to feel the emotion. We have to have that experience. We're not our emotions, but we have to have that be the threshold towards healing, right? That we have to experience that. And I think we've busied ourselves in this country, maybe even worldwide, where we're just so busy and functioning from the space, you know, in our head that we forget or we don't take responsibility for how we show up in our emotions and help heal the past.
Right. And how to take responsibility for the way we feel. So if we're feeling very angry, we don't have to pick up a machete and kill someone. You know, that there are appropriate ways of dealing with it. And those are the mechanisms we need to have in place. The other little twist to telling stories, just like when you told your story of Prague and how this inspired you, we all could feel it. And that actually opens us up to be more persuaded to do something about it. So it's actually that emotional storytelling can also help in persuading others to take a step in a direction that could be a healing direction.
Mm-hmm. Which goes back to the work that you just did in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's some people who really respond to emotions. All of us right here do. There's some people who really respond to the thinking, you know, cognitive place. And so you have those facts in the story that will really resonate to them. So these are ways to really get people to help them get on board to making a difference in this world.
Wow. We could go on and on and on.
Well, you know, it's like when you work out physically, you know, no pain, no gain. But when you're doing this, you want to move on and you want to do something worthwhile for the community. And for your group of people, whomever they may be, you've got to go through this pain of looking at something and hearing the stories and understanding it. It's essential to do that. I mean, you just can't deny that it happened. You have to face it.
And the other interesting thing about that is when you listen to someone's pain and when you give someone an opportunity to share their pain, that's what helps the pain dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where some of the healing is already taking place. When someone knows you are really listening and that they are being heard, it helps to alleviate that pain. And it's that kind of sharing. I mean, we're all here and there's a closeness we're all feeling because we're sharing these kinds of stories. And that's what adds really the texture and richness to all our lives. At least that's what I believe. And it makes our world and our lives much more meaningful as a result.
John, with the Genocide Conference, what kinds of action or calls to action do you find that speakers, or is that a piece of it, that they come and they share their wisdom and their stories? Is there a call to action as a conference itself, or do you find that speakers really, you know, once the participants are moved, that they give them somewhere, you know, to go next?
I see. Okay. One gentleman is who Holocaust survivor, and his father was murdered by the SS in a camp, and he was used as slave labor in the camp and such. His call to action for people who listen to him is respect, because it actually, the using respect saved his life from a German, because he was a German Jew for Leipzig. And you can come and hear his story on Monday at 10:30 if you want. Oscar Knobloch is his name, phenomenal speaker. But he will explain how he respected this German who was his captor. It saved his life. And people ask him, "Do you hate Germans?" And he says, "No, I don't." He said, "There are some Germans who saved my life, and I can get along with them." Whereas there's another gentleman that I, you know, and he can't. He was a Bosnian, and he was in 6 Croatian concentration camps. And somebody asked him, can you ever forgive them? And he says, no, they deny it happened. He said, even this morning, the president of Croatia denied that anything took place. You know, there were concentration camps and such. And he can't, he's not at the point now where he can forgive. He's told his story, and he tells it, and he wants people to listen to it. But he's not there yet.
And he's honest about it.
Yeah, oh, he's very honest.
And that's what makes it healthy.
Yes, exactly.
Because you can't just say you forgive when you're harboring all this anger and resentment. But you also bring up an interesting point that even when we take a look at the other, not all of those others are bad people. You know, and it reminds me of a story that my uncle shared with me. He was in the army during World War II, and he was captured. And the German soldier that was responsible for them, when there was certain kinds of things that would happen where people had to go out, you know, the prisoners had to go out to clean up, he would not let any of the Jewish prisoners go out in that public to clean up because he was afraid that other Germans would see them and try to hurt them and kill them, even though, you know, they're in the prison suits and everything. Mm-hmm. And so he let them stay back when they had certain details where he was concerned that if they went into the public areas, that they could be hurt or killed. So there were things like that. I've got many stories. Those are the stories I heard. My other uncle told me his best friend became a Nazi, part of the Nazi youth. And yet he would tell my uncle, don't be here for Kristallnacht. Or if you really want to get out of the country, you better leave by this time. And other things that basically saved his life. So there's stories like that all over. And we need to hear those too.
Well, thank you for sharing your stories and your time with us. Our listeners are what we call 100% intentional listeners. So those who are looking for more information about the topics we're talking about, hopefully will land here. And then this podcast also is available for download, and people can turn them into smaller sound bites so that more people can consume what we're discussing, and hopefully just let it spread like wildfire. Well, wildflower, let's call it that too. Say both work. John, one more time, if you could, as we round out and close the segment, tell us again about the conference, how we can get registered, 6 days.
Okay, the conference is at Scottsdale Community College. It starts on Monday, the 15th of April, and it runs through the 20th. There are primarily the first 4 days. You don't have to register for anything. It's free and open to the public. All people have to do is come and park. You should go to parking lot A, B, or C. Those are the closest ones. There's a myriad of different things going on, not only presentations, but exhibits. There's a very important ceremony that's going to happen on Tuesday night with the Israeli Boy Scouts. And that's going to be pretty big. It's probably going to be 500 or 600 people there. And then on Friday night and Saturday night, there's a play called Dark Road. And Friday morning is only for police officers and prosecuting attorneys. It's a workshop that's on ethics that's comes out of the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And Saturday is an educator's workshop that's free, open to all teachers. There'll be some food there for a little breakfast, a little lunch. And the person speaking is Christian Delage. Dr. Delage is coming in from Paris. He's the man who wrote the book and did the exhibit and the film from Hollywood to Nuremberg. So we're quite fortunate to get him to come in. But we have Eileen. I got to say, Eileen is going to speak on Wednesday, April 17th at 9 in the morning. So if you want to come and meet her, her book is for sale in our bookstore. So the authors that are coming are going to speak, and then they'll be happy to sign copies of the book too. If you want more information, it's easy to find. All you have to do is Google Scottsdale Community College Genocide Awareness. And the first thing that pops up is the landing page, and you can find everything on there.
And what's ahead for this conference? You mentioned early on that you're already, you know, ready to move on to the next one.
Well, in 2020, we have Father Patrick Dubois coming. And Patrick Dubois is a world-renowned priest from France who did a lot of work in the Ukraine, finding the mass graves of Jews who were murdered by Ukrainians and by Nazis. Now he's spread out a little bit, and he's working in Syria and Iraq, finding mass graves of the people that ISIS killed. And so he's coming, and we have an exhibit of his and a workshop for educators, too. So that's 2020.
I have an 11-year-old. I have two in their 20s who've since moved out of the house and still here live here locally. Is it at what age is this conference appropriate for?
That's a great question. It's not unusual for middle school students to come and attend. In fact, for Oscar, who's we put him on Monday in the morning, there's always busloads of students that come
to
hear him speak. And he's very, very popular. He's an amazing individual. And I can't urge enough people to come and to hear him
speak. What day does he speak again? What
time? He speaks on Monday at 10:30 in the morning. Okay. So that's Monday the 15th.
Yeah. So yes, middle school.
Middle school.
And based on maturity,
yeah,
would be an appropriate family event.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
But it's open to the community as
well. Sure,
and
right.
So Monday night, we have Clementine Wamaria, who's a very important speaker.
Are you going to be videotaping or any kind of taping that people who can't make it to some of these events would be able to go on a website?
Great question again. Yeah, we do. We do tape everything, and we put it on a link, as it were, so that teachers and anyone who's interested can use it, download it, use it for their classes or whatever they want to use it for.
Excellent. So, John, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for
it's
the work
pleasure.
That you're doing. Thank you for sharing everything that's going on right here in our backyard, an important event to get involved with and come and learn from. I now need to go look at your website and find out where in my life next week can I make time for it and obviously plan for the years in advance so that I'm committed to continue to learn and grow with you. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
How about you, Eileen? What will you be speaking about next week?
I'll be speaking about healing hate in America and sharing some of the things that we talked about today, because many people don't realize there have been truth and reconciliation type commissions and the healing that we need to be doing and how to go about in doing it. So I'm going to start talking about that, starting with the story of what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, but then bringing in, you know, to more recent events and how we heal hate, the question that you asked, and what can we do about it and how can we move forward. And there's going to be a little nice surprise that will lighten things up at the very end, which I can't even tell John, but I think people will like. I just need some audio and visual to help me.
Okay.
And I'm really looking forward to it. And it's something that I, as you know, care so much about, the healing of nations around the world and right here in the United States. That's my passion. And I'll be talking also about political forgiveness and what that looks like and how we can use the process of political forgiveness to heal nations.
And your book, where can we find your book? The book is entitled
Finding Forgiveness, the 7-Step Program for Letting Go of Anger and Bitterness. And it's published by McGraw-Hill. You can find it on Amazon. And I'm now working on a second book on political forgiveness and the healing of nations. So hopefully that will be done by next year so I can tell you,
hey. I was just going to say, come back. Yes, I know I'll see you before that, but we would love to have you back again. And John, you as well. Let's have this conversation be an annual conversation. And we've got two more seats, so be thinking already about who else needs to be part of this conversation with us. And where do we find you on the internet?
Yeah, I have a website, Dr. Boris, BORRIS.com. And you can see it's some of the things I've been able to do. Afghanistan is not up there yet because I just came back and then started focusing on what John wanted.
Mm-hmm.
If they needed to get in touch with me, if they are interested in wanting even counseling, because I have my private practice where I work with people having individual difficulties dealing with anxiety and depression, as well as couples going through difficulties or separation and divorce, they can email me, erboris, B as in boy, ORRIS@cox.net.
And a note about that, when we can heal ourselves and come back to wholeness, we are contributing and participating in a way that makes a huge difference all over the globe. So if you're feeling like after you've listened to this broadcast that, well, who am I to help or what can I do? Yes, we want you to have a call to action and get involved and start learning and making a difference, but also take full responsibility for doing that in your own personal life as well.
Exactly.
Wouldn't you agree?
Exactly.
Yeah. And let Eileen help you do that if you need the assistance. Yeah.
I would love that. And everyone does make a difference.
Absolutely. Both of you are linked on LinkedIn as well. Is that a good place for people to connect
on
with
LinkedIn.
You? Yes. And then I know when you were in Afghanistan, was it Facebook where I got to see a few of your little, you know, blogs and your stories around what was that like to be there?
Yes.
So also active on Facebook?
Yes, mm-hmm. I am. And people can read some more of the stories. I'll be probably posting after the genocide week is over. I'll start writing again and posting, because all of these stories are so important. And I welcome people's stories too that they can send me, because I like putting those stories up if they'd like them to be up and to talk about them.
Very good. John, for the Genocide Conference, social media, is there somewhere we can find out more, or is it strictly the...
Well, we've got the landing page, and if you tap into SCC, their page, you can
they're putting it out there as well.
They'll put it out there too.
Okay. That the answer didn't have to be yes.
Yeah.
I was just curious. Absolutely. Well, again, I'm humbled, I'm honored, and I'm so deeply appreciative of the work that both of you are doing. And I know it's not just the two of you, right? We're talking about massive amounts of speakers, folks who are willing to come tell their story and share. And the work that you're doing, it takes so many people. So for those friends and folks who are part of your tribes and helping, we want to thank them as well, because I know we can feel their presence and they're a big part of who you are and what you're doing. You've been listening to Phoenix Business Radio with Business Radio X, broadcasting live from within the Max 6 and Conscious Capitalism Arizona studio. Some media leans left, some lean right, and we lean business. Until next time, I'm Karen Nowicki.